Welcome to Three Women, Three Ways. I'm Heather Stark, your host. We've been doing this show for several years now. One time, about 3 years ago, I had a guest on the show who was a family court judge from Denver. And she had some interesting perspectives, some of which surprised me. And it was just a very enlightening show, although I must say, ultimately a little disappointing, too. I'm really privileged right now to have another family court judge with me, Judge Eugene Hyman. Welcome, Judge Hyman.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for being with us. I'm going to give our audience a little bit of an introduction to you. It's not a comprehensive one, but you served for 20 years on the Superior Court in the Criminal, Family, Juvenile, and Probate Divisions of the Court. And the Juvenile, Domestic, and Family Violence Court began in 1999, probably the first such court in the U.S., and it received the United Nations Public Service Award in 2008. You also have an extensive experience teaching all around the world. You've been teaching domestic violence-related subjects in Canada, Australia, Germany, New Zealand, and, of course, in the United States. So that's an impressive background. Tell me briefly about your background. How did you become a judge? How did you get involved with domestic violence and the family courts?
Thank you. I always wanted to be a lawyer, and then after graduating from college, I didn't get into law school initially, so there was something I needed to do while I was waiting. So I became a police officer in the city of Santa Clara, and I was there for almost 5 years, and subsequently I got into law school, attended law school part-time. And after becoming a member of the bar, I practiced criminal defense for about a year, year and a half. Then I did workers' compensation. And while I was involved with the practice, local practice, I became very active with the county bar. And as a result of my working with them and with other groups, I became interested in becoming a judge, applied for a judgeship, and in December of 1990, I was appointed to the municipal court. And after 6 years on the municipal court, I decided to run for an open seat on the Superior Court. And fortunately, I won that seat. And then I went to the Superior Court, where I subsequently sat until my retirement in March of 2011. I've been involved in domestic violence prevention for almost 30 years, and I became interested in prevention when I had a relationship with a survivor of domestic violence. And she gave me a perspective that I had never had before, because prior to that, I had read about it and had a basic understanding, but she was able to communicate to me what it was like to actually be a survivor of domestic violence. And as a result of that, I became very involved in domestic violence prevention, first at the municipal court and secondly in the Superior Court. And even after my retirement, I continued to teach it. And am actively involved in various kinds of activities to try and do a better job of intervening and helping not only survivors, but also their children. And that's what I've been doing for almost 30 years.
Well, I want to ask you a lot of questions about the family court and the family court process, but I also want to focus on this DV prevention. So often when we're talking about domestic violence or intimate partner violence or whatever term you want to use in these days, we're talking about kind of picking up the pieces and helping survivors. We don't hear a lot about prevention programs. We hear about perpetrators being sent to programs that, you know, quite honestly, marginally successful. But we don't hear a lot about prevention. So can we talk about that a little bit? Why prevention? What does prevention involve? Why don't we hear about it more frequently and on actual domestic violence prevention?
Sure. prevention is bringing it to the schools. It would be predominantly at the high school level, although I have heard of some programs that begin in middle school. And we talk about what healthy relationships look like. And then they talk about what to do if you're in an unhealthy relationship. Because there's been studies that indicate that a large population of women become involved with their abuser at early ages, everything from 12, 13 on up. And a very high percentage of those 12 and 13 and 14-year-olds ultimately become in long-term relationships with men who not only batter them, but a percentage of them actually murder them. So it's kind of like the necessity, the importance of teaching what a healthy relationship looks like, because most of us learn about relationships from our parents. And if you are in a relationship where there is domestic violence, then if you're the male, your model is seeing your father or your mother's boyfriend in the event of divorce abusing your mother, and you begin to normalize that. And if you're a young woman, a girl, you see maybe your mother being abused, and you just sort of say, well, gee, I guess that's sort of the way it is. You know, they have all the control. You do what they want. You don't get beaten. You don't do what they want. They get upset. They do beat you. So it's like, you know, what does a healthy relationship look like? And most people have no idea what a healthy relationship looks like. We react to a certain extent based upon what we observed with respect to our own parents. The other thing,
you know, this,
with respect
to... If I could interrupt you just briefly there, that's a very interesting perspective, because I'm, you know, I always say I'm older than dirt. And in my era, we grew up on Lucille Ball reruns, and even who was the one, Jackie Gleason, you know, To the Moon Alice, and you know, and we grew up watching reruns of all these TV shows. And then when I was a little older, then they brought out the Cosby Family and all that other stuff. So I think that a lot of the media that older women were exposed to definitely modeled a certain level of dysfunction. I knew I hated watching I Love Lucy because she was always although she ostensibly was not abused, she was always coming up with these schemes, these little kid schemes to hide things from hubby, who was clearly the one in control and in charge if she had to hide things from him. And, you know, and those were the kinds of models that I had. But I also grew up in a very dysfunctional home. And so when I saw things like the Cosby Family, and I thought, wow, this must be normal. Well, you know, time has proven, you know, about the actors and that. But the show itself, it was kind of modeled as, okay, this is a healthy family, this is normal. But my children still laugh at me because I would often say as they were growing up, no, normal people don't do this. You know, normal people do this. Let's do it this way, because this is the way normal people do it. And I was just grabbing at what I was trying to construct normalcy because I didn't have that model. And so that's a very interesting, you know, what you're describing. I think it's very common. And so can you elaborate a little bit on, you know, what a curriculum is for healthy relationships?
Well, it talks about mutual respect. It talks about the freedom to say no and what consent and no mean. And let's face it, it's very difficult to talk about sexual relationships in general, let alone when it's young people, and especially when you've got parents that might be concerned that if you're talking about sex, then somehow you might be encouraging it. And so you have to be respectful with respect to people's different feelings about the topic and about the curriculum. So it isn't in, excuse me. It isn't in as many schools as I would like. My feeling is that either we talk about it, in which case we have an opportunity to prevent a lot of violence and a lot of pregnancy, or we can just continue to bury our heads in the sand, in which case you're going to have more dysfunction and the potential for violence than you might otherwise if you took a chance. So, but it isn't just prevention in the sense of having healthy relationship classes. It's also prevention in the sense of having good interventions for survivors of domestic violence, including survivors of juvenile domestic violence, as well as survivors of adult domestic violence, because a lot of survivors, unfortunately, get involved in subsequent domestic violence situations. So, again, they don't know how to navigate, how to stay safe, how to say no. So they don't know what a healthy relationship looks like. So these programs, whether it be juvenile or whether it be adult, they help to be supportive in terms of helping them go forward. It's important that we have good intervention programs for survivors of domestic violence, both adult and juvenile, because a lot of them get into subsequent abusive relationships. So they need to be assisted voluntarily. In other words, no one forces any programs on survivors, and assist them in terms of what a healthy relationship looks like and how they can navigate a healthy relationship. And then it's also important in part of the domestic violence intervention programs, battery intervention programs for perpetrators. Part of the responsibility of the program is to also teach to have men have the ability to be more egalitarian, less controlling, and non-abusive. I mean, obviously, violence is unacceptable. I have found that a lot of men learn how to be nonviolent, but what is more difficult to learn is how to be less controlling and less abusive in nonviolent ways. So these programs also teach that. And unfortunately, this is very, very difficult behavior to correct. It isn't the success rates are pretty low for these kinds of programs, which is even more of a reason to help women understand options so that they can leave abusive relationships safely and move on with their lives.
Well, and you bring up an interesting point with the controlling behavior, because a lot of times, I think actually over the last 30 years or so, we've done as a society a pretty good job of making, defining domestic violence as physical abuse, broken bones, black eyes, and yes, frowning upon that behavior. But we have done an abysmal job of defining abuse as anything other than black eyes and broken bones. And as you have just pointed right out, that controlling behavior, the studies show that many women, you know, if given an option of experiencing the physical violence or the controlling behavior again, they will go for the physical violence, because broken bones heal, black eyes heal. But what is happening to your brain and your personality and, you know, with that controlling and abusive behavior, that's not so easily repaired often. So it's interesting to me that you mentioned the controlling behavior. Do you agree with my assessment? Do you think we've done a pretty good job about the physical stuff, but not so much about the controlling behavior?
We've done a good job in terms of understanding the physical. Unfortunately, we haven't stopped by any means the physical. Women are still being murdered at a shocking rate. And women are still being hurt in their children. Well, what we've discovered with research is not only are abusive men abusing women physically and psychologically, but they're abusing their children physically, psychologically, and sexually. Not all of them, but I mean, So that's one way of controlling the woman is to abuse the child and say, hey, look, you leave, I'm going to get custody of the child and I'm going to continue to abuse the child or the animal or some other object of importance, and that forces a lot of women to stay. So the other problem is in terms of getting women legal assistance to assist them in leaving. And unfortunately, you have the right to an attorney if you're in the criminal system and you can't afford one. We don't have an equivalent of a public defender system for people in family court. And that's what we also need. Because 70% of people, both men and women, not just women, 70% of people in the family system are self-represented, and somehow they get through it. But if that's one thing, if you and your partner are, you know, just not getting along and want to get divorced, you might disagree about certain things, but it really becomes critical when a woman is being abused and she's getting a divorce. To do that by yourself is just incredibly difficult, especially when you're talking about child custody. So if we really wanted to make a difference, we would have some kind of a system for those that meet certain economic thresholds to have court-appointed family lawyers.
The problem, that's interesting. You know, obviously, I am all in favor of that because so many women really get the short end of the stick because they are trying to represent themselves
right.
because they don't have the resources.
Right.
However, it's interesting that you talk about that because just because, you know, when you're talking about establishing financial levels, criteria, income levels, presumably, of who could qualify for assistance, there's a small segment of people, well, maybe not so small, of women who are married to very wealthy men, and they are blocked out of all sorts of resources that they could use because their income level is too high. The problem is that a lot of those women who are being abused are cut out of control of the income.
Absolutely.
So just because he is wealthy doesn't mean she is. And I can name you one other woman who tried to apply for food stamps or Medicaid for their children, and no, you didn't qualify, you don't qualify, but meanwhile, they have nothing. It's the husband
right.
who has it. And so I kind of worry a little bit when we talk about income criteria for things like that, because, you know, if quite honestly, it's those wealthy women whose husbands will hire, you know, a legal team to basically crush them. And so that's just something I'm throwing out there. For, you know, let's not forget the poor rich women, because they're not really rich, apparently.
Absolutely. That's another way to control. That's
exactly.
another way of control.
Yes. And in talking about the ways to control, I'm going to swing us a little bit back to the family courts and how they operate, because, of course, you know, if she's no longer living with you, what you can do to control her is to do whatever you can to the kids, especially going for custody. And we have seen various studies, probably the most significant of which is Joan Meyer's study that came out last year. About the likelihood, the overwhelming likelihood that an abuser will get custody
yes.
of those children.
Yes.
Whether he has ever been
yes.
a custodian before, whether he has ever had any real deep involvement with the children, whether the mother has been
yes.
an exemplary child protector, it doesn't matter. If those abusers want
yes.
custody, the courts are giving it to them. Could you talk a little bit about
yes.
that, why that's happening?
Well, I really think, in a lot of cases, not all cases, I mean, there are many excellent family law judges, and then there are many judges that aren't excellent, just like there are many good lawyers, many bad lawyers, many good police officers, some police officers aren't, many good prosecutors, some that aren't, many good public defenders, some that aren't. So you've got good
sure.
ones and some that aren't as good. I mean, that's everywhere. But I really think there's an implicit bias problem. And when people talk about implicit bias, usually they're talking about race, religion, things of that nature. I also think there's an implicit bias with respect to women who are experiencing abuse, whether it be domestic violence abuse, sexual assault, I mean, all kinds of abuse. And I think the way the implicit bias plays out is that there's this sense that, gee, why does she stay if it's so bad? And if you continue to stay, somehow it isn't that bad. And, I mean, there's been study after study in terms of why women stay, and there's very good reasons why women stay. sometimes they're concerned about the abuse getting worse. Sometimes they're worried about their children or their pets. Sometimes they don't have education, can't speak English, and the batter is the sole support. I mean, there's at least 50 reasons that if we had the time, I could go over in terms of why women stay. So they stay for very good reasons. But there's a prejudice against them. There's a whole bunch of lawyers that I know that if a woman tells them a story of abuse, their theory is not to mention it. They feel that there's a prejudice with respect to evaluators in the courts with respect to women that claim abuse, and it's only going to be worse for them in terms of outcome. And they recommend that women not raise those issues. That I don't think that's good advice, but I've heard that that's the advice that some lawyers are giving. I feel that if there's any way to stay out of the court system, this is whether there's domestic violence or not. I mean, this isn't limited to just domestic violence. If there's any way to avoid going to court, I would recommend that you do that. I would recommend that you get a mediator. A mediator is a person who is like a judge, fair, neutral, and impartial. This person specializes in all aspects of family law, or they could specialize in certain aspects of family law, like child custody, like domestic violence issues. And this person would help both of the parties resolve their issues without going to full-blown litigation. The only problem with it is it requires two people who are willing to do that. And a lot of batterers are not willing to do that because they feel that they won't be able to control the outcome as well as if they're able to go to court. The other nice thing about mediation is you can select, you get to choose your mediator. If you're going in front of a judge, you don't get to choose your judge. Your judge comes off of a list. You file your petition in family court, family relations court, whatever it's called in your jurisdiction, and then you ultimately are assigned a judge. And that person might be good or that person might not be. Whereas if you're going into mediation or you're agreeing upon an evaluator, you're having some say over who that person is. And if you don't want to go to that person, you say, no, I'm not interested in going to that person. Whereas if you're assigned a judge, you have no choice. That judge is yours, and you can't do anything about it. And that person may not be a good fit for your particular case.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here, Judge Hyman. When you're talking about a mediator and the being able to choose, et cetera, I have seen and heard of a lot of cases where the mediator is just one more form of bullying that the perpetrator can use. Oh, no, I won't take that mediator. No, I won't agree to that mediator. No, I won't agree to that one. It can become another source of abuse to select that, just as, you know, if you're selecting do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
I think the most difficult cases are domestic violence cases because the abusive partner and controlling partner is going to make resolution difficult. You know, that kind of case is probably going to wind up in front of a judge more than in front of a mediator for the reasons that you just discussed. So, no, I agree. It depends upon whether you're represented or unrepresented, and it depends upon the attorney that's representing you, because there are attorneys that specialize in representing batterers, and they help perpetrate. They help perpetrate the abuse. So in which case, then what you need is a strong judge who's going to, you know, keep it on an even keel and keep it moving forward. And some judges are better at that than others.
Well,
now,
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, when it comes to the judges, what I have seen is that obviously there are some good judges, well-educated judges, but overwhelmingly what I've seen is that these abusers get away with a lot, an awful lot, and it's just, well, we'll come back and visit this in 30 days, or, well, you have 30 days to fix this, and then you go back in 30 days. It's not fixed, but they did a little something, so, okay, we'll give them another 30 days. But what I have seen, and I find it kind of amusing, is that if the judge gives an order, or it seems like the judges come down hard on the perpetrators once the perpetrators do some contrary to the judge, not necessarily contrary to the victim. I'm not sure if I'm articulating that very well, but do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Is that just basic human nature, or is that something that's endemic in the system, or?
Well, I think based upon my experience with domestic violence is that you're correct. You need judges that are not going to give a lot of slack. Now, you always get a lot more slack if you're self-represented than if you have an attorney, because if you have an attorney, the judge is going to expect the attorney to do things, correctly. But you need especially in domestic violence situations, you need a strong judge who doesn't let the parties get away with anything and keeps them to the fire. But on the other hand, if you're self-represented, and if you don't get it done correctly, as long as you're trying, you're right. There's going to be allowances for continuances, and that's a problem, which is why I advocate for some kind of a system that's based upon income to assist parties in moving their cases forward, because it is so difficult doing it yourself. It's difficult if you're educated. It's difficult if you have a lawyer, let alone doing it. I mean, I'm amazed at the people that somehow get through the system that have not had a lawyer along the way. I mean, I don't know how they do it.
I've met a lot of women who could probably pass the bar exam after having gone through representing themselves, studying, learning, and, gathering up documents. That should be a whole separate thing that I should look into, because I know in Washington State, or at least it used to be, maybe they've changed it, you didn't actually have to go to law school to take the bar exam. And so that would be interesting if people who self-educated going through these experiences could actually pass the bar and become attorneys. That would be an interesting This is where my brain goes, Judge.
it's not that easy, because you have to be under the supervision of a lawyer or a judge. They have to give you quizzes and tests, and the person who's supervising you has to certify that you've had so many hours of studying. I mean, you can do it, but it's not easy. It isn't like, hey, sign up and take the bar. You have to prove all these other things first. So it's a 4-year deal at least. It's not easy.
We all know the great attorneys who have taken 2 or 3 passes before they could get through that bar exam, so it must be very, very difficult.
I don't think there's any causal relationship between passing the bar and practicing law. This business about that if you pass the bar, you're competent, I don't think necessarily so, but that's another topic for another day. I think that Finding good lawyers at affordable prices is a great difficulty, and what a divorce can cost you is just unbelievable. For a divorce where people are basically getting along, I don't see how you can do it for less than $25,000, and that's a lot of money.
When you're divorcing with one of these controllers, they would rather spend every dime than allow their
That's right. And they're spending money that people have set aside for college and everything else. I mean, it's really tragic. And, of course, if you live in L.A., it's much more expensive than in Northern California. It's prohibitive. And we need to come up with a better way to do this.
So is anybody working on that in the legal field and coming up with a better way to do this?
Well, you have a movement called collaborative law, and that is working. You have collaborative lawyers that work with their clients in terms of preparing them for mediation and not for litigation. This requires people that are willing to set aside their anger, their disappointment, and everything else, and go before an experienced person that explains the law to them and helps them divide things, helps them come up with a meaningful child visitation program. That kind of law isn't going to work with serious batterers, because they're just not willing to be serious about it. So, but it does work for a lot of people, and it's a movement. It truly is a movement, because the lawyers that are doing it are not interested in litigating. As a matter of fact, some of them, if their clients can't settle their cases, they move them on to other lawyers, because those particular lawyers are not interested in litigation. They're interested in mediating and working out settlements. That's how they view their role, and that's how they view a success, and that's how they view happiness. And then you've got some lawyers that just really enjoy in courtroom and battling it out and cross-examining and making people cry and everything else. You've got all different kinds of people out there. But there is a movement, and I think that they are motivated the right way. It's just that, unfortunately, it requires people that truly want to resolve their case without scorching the earth, and that doesn't happen every day.
No, and it certainly doesn't happen in cases where there's this kind of abuse. So
no way.
Let's move to the topic of guardians ad litem. I think what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to ask you questions about all of this, what I call the industry, the divorce industry. I mean, it's not uncommon
right.
for these contentious divorces to have psychologists, one for him, one for her, psychologist, one for the child.
Oh, absolutely.
A guardian ad litem, if not two. Then we have the
absolutely.
Mediator, and then we have the child protective services,
right.
blah, blah, blah. And it just is amazing and astounding the number of people who are, and I'm going to sound crass here, who are getting a cut of it. And
yes.
I'm wondering your opinion of all this. Is all of this really necessary? Is, you know, what's a better way to do it? Can you comment on that, that kind of ancillary personnel
well,
that are always involved in these
sure.
difficult divorces?
Well, the best way is if you can agree on experts so that there's only one expert rather than two experts. So you agree that this person will do a custody evaluation, and you each agree that this person is fair, and you pretty much are going to follow their suggestions. With respect to guardian ad litem, courts usually appoint lawyers for children where there is great difficulty within the family. Sometimes it's domestic violence, sometimes it's substance abuse, and other kinds of very, very difficult issues, to represent the interest of children in high-conflict divorces. Now, we call them in California minors children, minors counsel. And depending upon the attorney, they can do an excellent job. So let's say that the parents are unrepresented, and then you have an attorney for the child. The attorney for the child or for the children can make recommendations to the court, and sometimes that can be very helpful in terms of resolving the case. Unfortunately, there's always the depends. There's always the but. It depends upon the minors' counsel in terms of how fair they are and how much weight the judge gives to the opinion of minors' counsel. It's my position that minors' counsel is just is a conduit for information to the court, and the court needs to process it, think about it, and needs to do what the court thinks is in the best interest of the children. But I think it's wrong to always do what minors' counsel recommends. I think it's wrong to necessarily always do what the evaluators recommend. You know, a judge is not a rubber stamp. A judge hears evidence, applies the facts as the judge determined them to be to the law that is in the state with respect to whatever issue you're deciding, whether it be child custody or financial interest or dividing community property or whatever it is. Experts give opinions and judges make orders. Sometimes, depending upon the judge, sometimes judges are more than happy to let others make decisions. And I think that's where we get into difficulties. I think judges are there to make hard decisions. They certainly should listen to what experts have to say, that to the extent that they disagree with an expert, then they need to make their own decisions. And sometimes that doesn't happen.
I'm going to give you a scenario of a situation that I know of where a guardian ad litem was selected. She was an attorney, and the parents were each asked to list resources or people to recommend, recommendations, I guess, for their parenting, people who had known and seen them parent. The mother had been a very active parent in the school program. She listed every teacher that the kids had. They all agreed to be on her list. She listed the PTA president. She listed some neighbors, and she listed the pediatricians. The father listed his Rotary buddy and his sister and his mother. The guardian ad litem saw the list and said to the mother, well, he only has three on his list, so you just pick three on your list, and which the mother did. And then the guardian ad litem wrote a summary, a recommendation that basically it should be 50-50, even though the father had been arrested for domestic violence, even though the father was very a very abusive man. And I have never understood that. Why would the guardian ad litem limit? I mean, wouldn't you, just seeing this list, wouldn't that give you a clue as to the quality of the parenting? And yet the guardian ad litem just, you know, can you comment on that? Is that typical?
It's very difficult for me to be able to assist your listeners because I just don't know all the information I would need to know to really be able to fully comment. It doesn't sound reasonable to me. It doesn't sound reasonable to me, but for me to really be helpful, I need to know a lot more information. Is that something that guardian ad litems or minors counsel are always doing? I can't. That wasn't my experience, but it could be in some jurisdictions, counties, whatever that might be. I don't know. I mean, it's just very difficult to be able to assess something like that.
Okay, and that's fair. I've just always been puzzled by that because I thought, wow, you know. The other question that I have in these additional people, these additional the whole psychologist issue, and you're right. Talking to a woman who spent the last 10 years working on a PhD in psychology, so I have a little bit of knowledge of what I was speaking with. And so often the psychologist evaluations are required either by the court or by the opposing parties, and those psychological evaluations consist of standard personality tests, or there is no test to determine whether you're an abuser. So psychologists rely on standardized tests, which don't necessarily tell you a thing about psychology or about abuse. And yet the courts seem to think that that's suitable, and many courts will just take psychological recommendations. What is your experience with the whole psychologist and in these divorce cases?
Well, I mean, you've got two types of evaluators. One type is the court's evaluator, and they work for a division of the family court in California. They're called Family Court Services, and most of them have masters. A few of them are going to have PhDs. And they do certain evaluations. They don't do extensive. They don't have the time to do extensive evaluations, but they are court evaluators. You still pay for them, but at a much lower rate. And then there are private evaluators, and almost all of them are PhDs. And so they interview. That's what I talked about earlier in terms of agreeing upon an evaluator. Otherwise, mom gets her evaluator, dad gets his evaluator, and those evaluations can cost anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000, depending upon, you know, what's involved and if they testify, if there's depositions. It really depends. I mean, it's going to be expensive. How expensive depends. And then if a psychologist thinks that one parent or the other might have a personality disorder that's important with respect to a parenting plan, then they can go ahead and request testing, and that's going to be another $5,000. So, you know, that depends. So the best thing that you can do is if a couple can agree upon an evaluator. But if it's a high-conflict divorce, if you've got domestic violence in it, that's going to be less likely that the parties are going to be able to agree in terms of one person doing an evaluation. Is there possibility or opportunities for abuse? Absolutely. It's one of the most expensive aspects of a case after the paying of attorney's fees are these child evaluations. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of money that is spent or can be spent.
Yeah, which leads me to the conclusion that the one with the least money, the party with the least money, is the one who's going to lose.
That very well might be. It depends upon who the evaluator is. It depends upon who the judge is, and it depends upon how the parties present themselves if they have a contested hearing. I understand that I'd like to be helpful to your listeners. But it's very difficult for me to be able to come to black and white conclusions because
right.
there are so many factors that enter into the decision-making process that I don't feel comfortable saying, yeah, this is always going to be the case, because it may not be. I mean, judges are important depending upon the role they wish to take during a hearing. I mean, if they take charge and they ask questions, because remember, in most states, I think Texas is an exception, in most states there are no jury trials in family law cases. So that means a judge hears the case, the judge makes a decision, and the judge, if he or she wants to, can actually ask questions. We don't ask questions a lot. We probably ask more questions if the parties don't have lawyers than if the parties do have lawyers, because if they do have lawyers, we don't want to be interfering with how the attorneys are presenting their cases. But if the parties don't have lawyers, then we probably are more inclined, if appropriate, to ask questions to get information to assist us in terms of making these important decisions. So, as I said, you know, in all the divisions of the court that I was in, family court was the most difficult assignment I had because of a lack of resources, because of a lack of attorneys, because of people that are super stressed and super worn out. And it is, all you see are just unhappy people, and it's just very, very difficult to be able to assist them. I mean, sometimes you can get a resolution, but I was never one for pushing in the sense of, well, you need to do this, you need to do that. I mean, I felt pretty strongly that people need to be in control of their lives. I mean, I might say to you, hey, if you do this, I think the outcome isn't going to be what you're hoping for, but you have the right to go ahead and go forward if you wish to. So what would you like to do? And, you know, then they make their decision. I think that taking child custody cases to court is the last thing you should do, because there's no way, no matter how hard you try as a judge, that you're going to know those children and you're going to know those parents to the extent that you would like to in making these most important decisions. And parents, you know their situations best, but sometimes a mediator can say to one parent, look, before the divorce, you weren't spending a lot of time with them, and so to want 50% of the time just isn't realistic given what was happening before you separated. And being able to point out in a non-threatening way that this is not in the best interest of the children, that you might be able to get more time as you establish a relationship and as you improve upon the relationship. And as the children get older, then it might make more sense to have additional timeshare at that time. But for now, this really isn't in their best interest. And to be able to explain that in a way that is non-threatening and that makes sense, and for a parent who is the who's spending the least amount of time prior to separation to understand that and to accept that is quite a skill set. And those are the kind of mediators you want.
Yeah, but again, we keep coming back to that. These are very contentious things, and if you have a person whose primary objective is to control, and that's more important than family relationships or children's health or anything else,
you're just hitting your head against a wall.
You know, you're just hitting your head against a wall there.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's pretty tough. Wanted to ask you about so you had mentioned that in many cases or often cases you've heard of attorneys recommending to their clients that they not mention abuse because it might put them in a, you know, that situation of implicit bias that you were talking about. I have heard the same thing about sexual assault of children, that parents are in fact being advised to not even mention that. And I have to say, I don't have a study to quote, but you know, the anecdotal evidence that I've heard makes me believe that there is something to this implicit bias if the sexual assault of children is implied or even suggested. Is that my imagination, or have you seen that?
Well, I haven't seen it, but I've certainly read about it. And it's a decision that, you know, an attorney in talking with their client, there are attorneys that believe that bringing up these issues with a judge or bringing up with an evaluator is going to have a bad outcome because of implicit bias. And I think that is certainly true. To what extent it's a problem, I'm sorry, I don't have any idea. But I certainly acknowledge that it happens, and I certainly acknowledge that it's a concern.
Yeah. Okay. And then one other question. One of the question that I asked the other judge that I was fortunate enough to have on my show to interview a couple years ago, I said, please explain to me what is going through a judge's mind when she or he is on the bench and in front of you are two people, one of whom has documented domestic violence and one of whom does not. What goes through the judge's mind in determining custody? And the response that this judge gave me was, well, you have to understand that you've got one person who is frantic and, you know, at her wit's end, and she just doesn't even have her own life together, let alone that of her children. And then we have the person who is pretty much calm and control and in charge, and he has his act together. So, and this is a quote, if the domestic violence wasn't that bad, we will give the children to him. Just about fell off my chair. Have you heard, well, I guess, can you comment on that particular experience I had with the interview?
Well, California and many states have a rebuttable presumption that if domestic violence, sexual assault, whatever is proved, then there is a presumption that the other party, that is the perpetrator, the abuser, should not have sole or joint legal custody of children, and that the non-abusive parent would get to make all the important decisions, legal and social, regarding the children in terms of the medical, the religious, their social. They get to make all the decisions. This doesn't mean that the batterer can't go to school night. It means that he needs to go at a different time when the victim won't be present. He has the right to talk to the teacher about how his child is doing, but he has no control over extracurricular activities, medical treatment, any of those kinds of things. And if he gets visitation, depending upon what he's doing, it might be supervised until he's able to complete some kind of an intervention program, and the judge has an idea in terms of whether he can be trusted terms of visiting with children without being supervised. So these are very, very scary people. And I think that you need to be, you know, you need to be very, very careful when you make orders regarding children that are in homes where there's domestic violence, because you never know if this person is ultimately going to decide to go ahead and murder the wife. And in a certain percentage of cases, not only do they murder the wife, they also murder the children on some kind of tortured logic that since the wife has been murdered, the other parent is going to be going into custody, and or maybe he's going to be committing suicide, in which case the children will be orphans and they're better off dead than being orphans. So this is part of it as well. Domestic violence perpetrators, they can make change, but it's very, very difficult. These are learned behaviors that have been going on for some time, and I think it's a serious mistake to conclude that by completing any kind of a program that somehow that means they're changed. What it means, in my view, is that they've been exposed to ideas, but if they're serious about changing their behavior long-term or permanently, that means that they have to continue to go to these programs, even when they're no longer required to go to programs by order of a court or something like that. It's like, you know, to give you an example, if you have a substance abuse issue, every person who has dealt with a substance abuse issue and is going to AA or NA understands that they're going to have to go to for these programs for the rest of their life. There's absolutely no mistake about it. But batterers somehow think I've completed the program. It was 20, 25 weeks. California is 52 weeks, and I'm cured. And nothing could be wrong from that thought. I mean, if you know, what is the difference between a domestic batterer and a Hell's Angel? The difference is that a domestic batterer is probably more charming. They're both equally potentially violent. It's just that we acknowledge the potential violence of a motorcycle gang member, and we don't necessarily always acknowledge the violence of a domestic violence perpetrator. A domestic violence perpetrator is capable of murder. If the perpetrator has strangled his wife or his partner, she's at 750% risk of being killed by that partner down the road. That's the association. So these are very scary people. There's no such thing as a safe batterer. People that are in a program and continue to do the program to check in, to check their controlling behavior, are much better off in terms of having healthy relationships. But this is something they constantly have to work at. They didn't become a batterer overnight, and you don't become a non-batterer overnight. You're used to dealing with situations in a violent way. And I don't care whether you're a Hell's Angel or whether you're a domestic batterer. You're a scary person. And those are difficult behaviors to change.
Yeah. You've summed that up very, very well, I think. Thank you very much, Judge. Question for you, a real brief question, because I'm looking at the clock going, oh, no, our time, we're coming to an end here. When you were on the bench, did you often deal with these cases? What percentage of the cases that you dealt with involved this kind of the abuse like we've been talking about? Is it 5%, 40%? Can you give me rough estimate?
I'd say between 20 and 25%. Because, one in four women have had violence in their lives. And so I think that's reasonable to say that with respect to domestic violence cases, declaring it might be a little bit lower, so it might be closer to 20% than 25%, but somewhere between 20 and 25% would be my best guess. I'm sure there's research on it. I just can't remember it off the top of my head.
There is. I just wondered from your personal experience.
It's tons of it.
Yeah. You know, I have about 50 other questions, but we're out of time. I'm not going to be able to ask them. One of the things that I always try to ask our guests is, you know, I clearly had my set of questions. Was there something that you want to talk about briefly that I didn't ask you about?
Yes, and that would be that it's extremely important that survivors of domestic violence contact advocates in their communities, because the advocates can assist them in the safety, can assist them in getting public benefits to which they're entitled, and can assist them in terms of finding lower cost options with respect to divorce, and can give them advice with respect to, or some advice with respect to the process in the community in which they're located. So I'm a big believer, contact the local advocates, the domestic violence shelters. They have all kinds of programs. They're very understanding. Please don't be embarrassed. Please contact them. And they're going to provide great resources in terms of keeping you safe, and also to the extent that they can, helping you with resources to keep food on the table. That's a biggie, I think.
I think that that's very good advice, and that's very good advice for us to close on. Judge, I am so grateful for you coming on the show. I really appreciate your knowledge. I know I asked you some questions that were probably not questions that you were expecting, but I do appreciate your willingness to share your experience and to share your knowledge about domestic violence. I would hope that at some point in the future you would be willing to come back, because I still have those 50 questions.
I'd be happy to. I'd be happy to. Thank you for the opportunity to spend quality time with you talking about something that's extremely important to me and I know extremely important to you.
Well, thank you, Judge Hyman. Thank you so much, and thank you for listening to Three Women, Three Ways.